From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The United States is seeing a very large acceleration in new coronavirus cases and could become the next epicenter for the global pandemic. That's according to World Health Organization spokesperson Margaret Harris this week. But Harris also said that the U.S. could turn it around. Question is, how might that happen? So for answers, we're going to look at places around the world that have either been ahead of or flattened that coronavirus curve. What did they do, and are those measures applicable in the United States now? This hour on Point, learning from successful fights against coronavirus. And we're going to begin today with Claire Standley. She's assistant research professor with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. Her research focuses on the analysis of health systems and international public health, with an emphasis on control and prevention of infectious diseases. And she joins us today from Heidelberg, Germany. Claire Standley, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, give us a picture in terms of how daily life right now is going in Germany, because there have been cases of coronavirus there.
Absolutely. And Germany is one of the countries that's been most affected by the pandemic. And so measures here are similar to that have been imposed in many places in the U.S. Restrictions on public gatherings, schools are closed, daycares are closed. Non-essential personnel are asked to be working from home, and public gatherings are restricted to no more than the nuclear family. So there's some very strong social distancing measures, although we're not in a complete lockdown as has been imposed in other places.
I see. Here's the interesting thing that, as far as I can tell about Germany, that it has roughly at least 30,000 cases as of this week, so not an insignificant number. But the mortality rate in Germany is incredibly low, less than 0.5%, which is remarkable when compared to what's going on in Italy right next door. And they're having, what, a 7% mortality rate there? Why the big difference?
So I think, one thing it's important to note is that it's a bit too early to tell whether that is, in fact, a true difference or perhaps a residue from sampling effort or other factors related to how the numbers are calculated. And certainly the head of the Robert Koch Institute here, which is the German equivalent of the CDC, has cautioned against taking those numbers at face value and says it's only after the outbreak is over that we'll really be able to tell. However, the numbers do seem promising, and I think early testing, early widespread testing, increased the proportion of mild cases that were detected, which, of course, is one way to bring the overall case fatality rate down.
Mm. Okay, well, so testing is going to come up repeatedly in this hour as we seek for lessons from these positive outliers around the world. So I will come back to that. But Claire, if you could just hang on for a moment. Now, I want to move over to Singapore. And here's a nation that has been very much ahead of the coronavirus curve. We want to spend some time talking about how that has happened. So Dale Fisher joins us now from Singapore. He's an infectious disease physician at the National University Hospital in Singapore. And he's also the chairman, Singapore-based chairman of the World Health Organization's Outbreak Alert and Response Network. Dale Fisher, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna. Happy to be here.
I'm really grateful to have you today. So first of all, Dale, if you could just give us a picture as to what the current state of coronavirus infections are in Singapore.
So we've managed to keep the curve very flat. We're still a bad day for us is 40-something cases, and maybe three-quarters of those are all imported. So we're managing to identify cases early, shut down transmission chains early, and in fact, as I said, most of our cases are imported. Now everyone arriving has to be on 14 days home quarantine, just to make sure that no new transmission chains are starting up.
Okay, so a very, very low number in a population of roughly 6 million people in Singapore.
That's right.
Now, one of the lessons, I mean, you've written extensively about this, and we'll put links to your writing at onpointradio.org, but one of the reasons why Singapore seems to be doing so well right now in managing coronavirus is because of its bad experience with the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s. Is that right?
I mean, that certainly helped in an ironic way. Even though that was 17 years ago, the memories are still fairly vivid. And it was actually only 200 cases. There's a very clear different mode of transmission. But nonetheless, it's made us very sensitive to emerging viruses. And from day one, you know, we were really prepared and we were ramping up. We had our first meetings on January the 1st. And really by the end of January, we had all our tests in place, our policies, processes, legislation, where we would isolate people, where we would quarantine. Everything was ready to go by the time we had a case.
Right. So let's talk about some of those specific things that were ready to go. First of all, isolation hospitals. So Singapore had a lot of hospitals already whose entire purpose was for anybody, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but anyone who tested positive for a coronavirus were isolated not just at home but in hospital facilities?
That's right. We only stopped that in the last few days, actually. We've had sufficient negative pressure single rooms across our public hospitals to be able to keep all the positive cases in hospital. That capacity is now being exceeded, so we're moving people into community isolation, as it were. So there's a hotel in Singapore which has been taken over, and that's got capacity to keep 500 positive cases until they're cleared.
I see.
This is actually an important message, Magna. In Wuhan, they created 50,000 beds. In Korea, they created 4,000 beds. So Singapore has really just created its first 500. There's lots more capacity to go, but we do believe in isolating the positive cases
instead of sending them home if they don't need hospitalization. So that's actually a big sort of a strategic difference here. Now, what about Singapore has been doing meticulous contact tracing as well for every case and every person that person might have interacted with. How is that contact tracing done?
So, yeah, this is another big differentiator, and I certainly don't want to compare ourselves with Europe and the United States now. We're all in different phases of the outbreak, but as you mentioned earlier, we were sensitized. So we've got, teams of quarantine officers, which are actually police in their previous jobs. They've all been sort of redeployed, and they will interview patients. They will find out where they've been in the last period of time. They will use they'll use CCTVs to find out who they may have been in the restaurant with, for instance. They'll track those people. Those people can have a quarantine order. I know it sounds very sort of over the top, but you know, we feel that this approach is actually ironically giving us more freedom, if you like, because we're not having to go through the lockdown of other places.
Right. And the details really matter here. And actually, they are very instructive, Dale. So in terms of for those contacts who have been in contact with someone who may have tested positive, just to be clear, you said that those people are asked to self-quarantine at home. And I'm fascinated by the fact that then Singapore authorities, multiple times a day, send them text messages with a link that they have to tap to confirm that, to basically geolocate them, that they're still at home?
I can testify to that personally because I was on the China mission in February, and yes, I was in quarantine and I received those very SMSs.
Okay. But then there's the tracing, and there's also the potential for penalties if people break the quarantine, right? I mean, I've been reading about how there have been some people have been taken to court or fined a lot of money if they defy the quarantine rules.
I mean, there are harsh rules, but they're definitely there as a deterrent. You know, it's seen as a major, public health sort of threat if you're breaching your quarantine. So it is only for 2 weeks. You're home. It's not, it's humane. We're only asking people to stay at home and not spread it. But you're right. The penalties are harsh.
Right. Well, I mean, and I don't think we should shy away from that, right? It's all part of the comprehensive approach that we're trying to learn from here that Singapore has taken. And I'm not saying that all of these measures would be effective in other countries around the world, but I am also curious about the communications that have been coming from the Singaporean government, because Dale, is this correct? When there was first news of coronavirus, that there was some panic shopping and some sort of more emotional reactions coming from Singapore. But then I read that the Singaporean president gave a speech that some public health officials are calling one of the best examples of risk communication they've seen.
That's exactly true. We were all a bit surprised when one day all the rice and the vegetable oil and the toilet paper had gone from the shelves. We didn't see it coming, but we think that the messaging is crucial. This is a disease that's spread through the community, so really the community engagement has to be you know, right up there, because the solution rests there. If the community doesn't behave responsibly, then you know you get into trouble as a community. So, even before our first case, we had an all of government approach, which was, you know, the minister, you know, from each department was together. We didn't see it as a health problem. It was also education, it was trade, it was tourism, it was, you know, the economy. So everyone got together in this group, which still meets regularly, and they give out regular updates to the community, and they're very transparent with the numbers, and they say, you know, they say what can go wrong, and they also say what's required of the community, and people, you know, by and large, but not invariably, get it, I think.
Yeah, and we've got to take a quick break here, Dale and Claire. Hang on just for one moment. I've got a couple more questions about Singapore, and then Claire, I definitely want your input about what we can learn here. We are talking about countries and regions that have gotten ahead of that coronavirus curve and what they've done to achieve that, and whether we can replicate any of that here in the United States. We'll be exploring a lot more of this when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to learn lessons from countries that have gotten ahead or flattened that coronavirus curve. So we're taking a look at Germany, at Singapore. We'll be talking about Taiwan and South Korea, and also a little town in Italy, of all places, as well. I'm joined today by Dale Fisher. He's an infectious disease doctor at the National University Hospital and is the Singapore-based chairman of the World Health Organization's Outbreak Alert and Response Network. He's with us via Skype from Singapore. And Claire Standley joins us as well. She's an assistant research professor with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University, with us from Heidelberg, Germany. And Claire, jump in here. What are you hearing, or what do you see in the Singapore example that is applicable in other places?
You know, I think Singapore has clearly been taking a very risk-based approach, and I think that's a model that can be applied in lots of other places. Taking the evidence, the experience, the really, really the good planning and preparedness that they had in place, and then deploying measures based on what they see as the greatest risks and the greatest threats in order to minimize societal disruption. So I think that's a very smart approach. It's obviously one that has to be quite carefully calibrated as well. We know there's a time lag between detection of cases and how social distancing and other measures can be effective. And so you need to be careful not to put in those responses too late. But it seems like Singapore is doing a really fantastic job so far.
Well, okay, be careful to not put in those responses too late. I just have to ask you then right up front here, Claire, is it too late in places like the United States?
You know, I think it's really difficult to tell. We don't know the true extent of transmission. I think the scale up of testing that's happened over the last couple of days and last few weeks has revealed many, many more infections than previously thought. And so it could be that in some localities, a different strategy needs to be taken. However, clearly this is, the United States is very heterogeneous. There's different pockets of transmission in different places. And so those state and local authorities are going to need to react to what's in front of them.
Yeah. Dale Fisher, let me turn back to you. And I've already, even last week, I got some tweets from people saying there is no point in using Singapore as an example, because the population is so much smaller, geographic size, system of government, cultural norms, that it's not really a useful example for the United States. And I was wondering if you might respond to that, and if you have, if you think there are still things that we can learn from Singapore.
Sure. Any outbreak response has to be adapted to the society. The environment that it's in, but these measures, which are early ascertainment of cases, testing, isolating of positive cases, contact tracing, monitoring the contacts, these are applied in Ebola in DRC. They're applied during the early stages of H1N1. They were applied during SARS. This is not a Singapore model. This is an outbreak response model, and how we're applying it in Singapore. I think ultimately, as Claire just said, the United States is very heterogeneous, and you couldn't even apply, I don't think, one model for every town and city and state of the United States. It's always going to be adapted how you communicate with your people, how you isolate people, how you contact trace, but they're the critical parts. Whatever the outbreak is, wherever the outbreak is.
Well, so federally, point taken because of the vast differences between the United States and places like Singapore. But Dale, what if we sort of refocused our frame of reference here and said, okay, let's talk about just New York State, because I mean, honestly, the front lines in the United States here are state by state, as you point out. And as of today, Johns Hopkins University estimates that there are some 55,000 cases of coronavirus in the United States, and half of them are in New York State, right? And we've got, 8 million people just in New York City alone. Are there things that can be done at the state level that maybe Governor Cuomo ought to be doing more of, as they're trying to get a handle on coronavirus just there?
That's an area I won't be drawn into, Meghna. I think there's a lot of people working very hard. I would urge the community to try and fall in line with the authorities, because people are making tough decisions. Mm-hmm. They're making them on the run. They're strategizing. And I think to divide the community is not going to help at all.
Well, Dale, let me just jump in here. The intent of the question was not a divisive one at all. I mean, I'm authentically seeking to learn from your experiences and see where and how, at any level, we could apply them in the United States. So if it sounded like I was trying to set people against each other, my apologies. That was honestly not the intent. I'm just sitting here in the United States and seeing that governors are the front line. They are the ones who are making the decisions, and they have been more proactive than the federal government here in the United States. And so that's why I kind of wanted to reframe as to what perhaps people could be doing at the state level.
Yeah, okay. Really, it comes back to those measures I said before. When things are out of hand, which, they are now, if you're getting cases pop up and you can't link them to other people, and there's this sort of community transmission, then really you have to make blanket interventions, such as, the social distancing and closures and public gatherings and that sort of thing. You just have to do everything you can. And that will work. It's painful on a society and an economy, but it will work eventually. But before life returns to normal, I think you'll find that most of the population still won't have been exposed. So you're still going to be quite vulnerable, and ramping up the things that perhaps could have been ramped up in retrospect through January, February, you know, with your testing and contact tracing and isolation and quarantine, getting all those systems in place while things settle down during a sort of a semi-lockdown, I think they would be the activities. There's going to have to be a lot of strategizing before you return to sort of normal, in inverted commas, about how you can do that safely.
I see. Claire, did you want to respond to that?
No, I couldn't agree more with what Dale said. I think clearly there's a second opportunity coming, assuming that these response measures are effective and we do see a flattening of the curve in even places that have been heavily affected, like New York. As Dale says, that's your opportunity to prepare and make sure that there isn't a resurgence in cases and that you have those measures in place to be more aggressive with contact tracing and case management when inevitably additional transmission occurs.
I see. Well, let's go to our callers here briefly. Let's go to Jack, who's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? It seems that both doctors are substantiating a view that I've had, that the primary difference between the response in the West and in the East has been one of testing for patient care, for creating care plans, versus in the East where it's primarily epidemiological. It's all about isolating people and restricting the spread, as opposed to figuring out for this one individual, do they need to be on a respirator, do they need to be in the hospital, et cetera. It sounds like my assumption was correct. My question is, to get back to the topic of the show, what can we do about this? Is a more strictly epidemiological approach in a country like the United States even possible? Mm. I mean, how would we go about telling people that, the apparently healthy checkout person at the grocery store, we actually need to give her more tests than the person that's coughing,
right?
Because she's a high risk of becoming a disease vector for the entire population.
Jack, thank you for that question. Dale, would you like to respond to him?
It's a good question, Jack. It's a tough question. You are where you are. There's no way of turning back the clock and say we wished we'd had testing at the beginning and could implement all those epidemiologic safeguards. I think your hospitals are quite possibly going to have a rough few weeks coming up, because we know you've got a lot of cases, and we know that some of those people will deteriorate. Some will get better. The majority will stay mild. But with those numbers, there's going to be a big demand on facilities. I think it's going to be, as I said before, really just taking the advice and stopping the transmission now. And you can't stop it with the contact tracing that would need to be implemented at this late stage. So you can only deal with it through, broad scale community interventions like are coming in place.
Mm. Dale, one last question before I let you go, because I want to circle back to something you said earlier, which I think is very, very important and it can be applied here in the United States. And that is, you had said that people in Singapore understand that the measures that are being put in place so far are the things that allowed continued freedom, that if the epidemic were to get worse, that's when things get further locked down. And so therefore they're much more cooperative, right? Did I hear that correctly?
I mean, I think we're starting from a more comfortable baseline. There's a lot of trust in government. It's a very horizontal government system. There's no layers like states. The opposition is not powerful, so it's a lot easier to do the messaging. Mm. Like you mentioned earlier, there's different challenges. Our challenge is that we've got nearly 6 million people on a tiny island that love to congregate. So maybe it was more important for us to get that, to have our approach.
Mm. Well, Dale Fisher is an infectious disease specialist at the National University Hospital and Singapore-based chairman of the World Health Organization's Outbreak Alert and Response Network. He joined us today via Skype from Singapore. Dale Fisher, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Magna.
Well, let's go back to our calls. Let's go to John, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a retired physician. And in regards to fever, the natural response of the body to infection is elevation temperature. Many viruses are very susceptible to an alteration in the body temperature. That is, when it goes up, it kills the virus. Are we making a mistake in this case by treating fever when we actually should be allowing the fever to go very high? Is, in fact, this virus heat labile, it's called.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you for that question. Claire Stanley, do you have an answer to that?
Look, I'm not a medical doctor, so I wouldn't want to comment on that side of it. But certainly, I think the information is probably being gathered. I'm sure there's a lot of research into that. So hopefully, we'll be able to have more answers about treatment protocols in the coming days and weeks.
Okay. So let me now turn to, and Claire, by the way, thank you for your transparency on that, because the last thing we want to do is have people surmise things that they're not that's outside of their area of expertise. So I actually really do appreciate that a lot. Let's go now to Padua, Italy, where Andrea Crisanti joins us. He's a professor of microbiology at the University of Padua. He's helped the town of Vo, Italy, bring its infection rate essentially to zero. So, Professor Crisanti, welcome to On Point.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
And Professor, how did you bring the infection rate in Vo, Italy, a town of 3,000 residents, to zero?
Well, it all happened because a number of fortunate coincidences. At the time of the first case of coronavirus was diagnosed, then the local authorities decided to lock down the entire village, and they ordered that everybody should be tested. This has never been done before. And so when we realized what they had did, in principle, they had created a unique epidemiological setting. And then we asked the authorities to do another survey 9 days later. And so we learned a lot of things doing this third survey. First of all, on the first survey, at the time of the first symptomatic case emerged, there were already 89 people infected, which was about 3%. So this we thought this was an enormity. We highlighted this to the Italian authority, but it was completely overlooked. And we have paid dearly in this this attitude.
Yeah, then Professor, if I can just jump in there, just to be sure that listeners fully digest what you're saying. You're saying that from the moment the first case was detected in Vo, Italy, because everybody got tested, you realized that there were 89 people who had the coronavirus, who perhaps some of them, I presume, at that time were asymptomatic. So you knew how many people in town had it.
Yeah, well, that was 3%, and 45% of them were completely asymptomatic, and they remained asymptomatic. They didn't progress into disease. Then everybody was put under domicile quarantine, and then 9 days after, we did another survey. At this time, we found that of those which on the first survey were negative, only 8 became positive. Again, they were all asymptomatic. They were put under quarantine, and since then, no new case have emerged in the small city of Vaud. But this second survey also demonstrates beyond any doubt that the asymptomatic can transmit, because 3 out of the 8 that we found positive on the second survey were relatives, and they were living in the same household of people that were asymptomatic.
I see.
The other 5 were more or less connected with people that were symptomatic. But there's no doubt that, beyond any doubt, that the asymptomatic can transmit the disease. And I think they are of the most, for most importance to identify them if you want to stop the progression of the disease.
I see. So if I may just jump in here again, Professor, so just because this is so important that you determined that 45% of the people in Vo, Italy, who had coronavirus were asymptomatic and yet they were capable of transmitting the disease. But you only knew that because of everyone being tested multiple times.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Two times. But if you want to draw a comparison, now you should think of the Diamond Princess. Again, there were about 3,500 people in a close community and under quarantine, but the approach was completely different. Japan decided to test only those that showed symptoms.
Right.
People got sick, they got the test, and they were removed from the ship. And I'm sure everybody remembered that every day there were tens of new cases, and after 14 days, there were 746 cases, which clearly shows that this is not the way to deal with infection. I mean, now we have really two very interesting examples that have been treated in a completely different way.
Professor Crisanti, I just have to take a quick break here, so stand by for just a moment, and Professor Standley as well. We will be right back. We're trying to learn from successful examples in fighting coronavirus around the world. A lot more in just a moment. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to learn from places around the world that have gotten a handle, or at least ahead of that coronavirus curve. I'm joined today by Claire Standley and by Andrea Crisanti. He's with us from Padua, Italy, and he's a professor of microbiology at the University of Padua. And Professor, I know that you're busy and seeing patients, so I appreciate your time. I just have one more question for you, because it sounds like the success in containing and even eliminating coronavirus from Vo, Italy. That's remarkable. And I heard you talk about the different approach that was taken on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. So given those two very different outcomes, what are the lessons that we can learn and that you say that you might say could or should be applied here in the United States now, if any?
Well, of course, I may say something which is not appropriate because I don't know very well the situation in the United States, but I can tell you what it should be done when you see a small cluster of a case in a town that up to this moment has never seen any infection. I think what you should do, depending on the side of the place, let's say it's in a small neighborhood or it's in a block of flats, I think you should isolate completely that area and test everybody. And so they identify everybody that is infected, you put everybody in isolation. Of course, this requires a kind of impact of resource that has to be concentrated in one point at one time. But if you're able to mobilize this resource, I'm sure the United States is an incredible country, it can scale up this very quickly, then you'll be able to keep at least the area of the country that has not been infected is safe. Then, of course, you have to implement a more generalized quarantine measure for a big area. And then, again, you have to start to ramp up this active surveillance measure, which are much more effective as the quarantine is strictly implemented. Because, in principle, the two multiply each other. And as soon as you start to see the effect of quarantine, the number of cases decreases, then you're able to implement this more quickly. Let's make an example. Now, if you, for example, that reflects the situation in Italy now, people, if they are healed, they call the health center, and very often they're told, well, you should stay at home and call us back again if you really feel very ill, and then they will admit you to hospital. Then now this approach is changing. If people call, especially in Veneto, which is the northeast part of Italy where Padua is, then we go there, we test the person, we test the family, we test the contact, which are the friends, and then we test the neighborhood. Now, we assume that these people have been implementing the quarantine correctly. So this means that this infected person must have got the infection within this circle of the circles of interaction.
Right.
And so this is where we look to find progressively all the people that are transmitting the disease. Now, if you do this systematically, if you put a lot of resource, I know it can be at the beginning frustrating and painstaking, slow, but it will have a dramatic effect because you fight an epidemic on three fronts, on the hospital, then on social distance, which is, of course, quarantine, and then active surveillance. Now, it's very difficult to reach a level of excellence on all these three, but it's by combining these three that you address the.
Well, Andrea Crisanti is a professor of microbiology at the University of Padua. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Bye.
And by the way, I just want to remind folks that Professor Crisanti was part of a team that tested 3,300 residents of Vo, Italy, the entire population of that town. And through the processes he talked about with us, they have effectively brought the infection rate of coronavirus to zero in Vo. Claire Stanley, just one quick question before we move over to Hong Kong. I was quite taken by the fact that Professor Crisanti said that they discovered that 45% of the cases that they tested were asymptomatic people who were still capable of transmitting the virus. So how might that knowledge shape or change what a proper response should be?
Well, it's a phenomenal statistic, and I think it was particularly important what he mentioned, that these are asymptomatic people who did not progress to get symptoms. They remained asymptomatic throughout the course of their infection, which is something that hasn't actually been talked about that much, I think, in the media with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic. It's a critical factor. It's a critical factor that's driving transmission, as Professor Crisanti alluded to. It's only through identifying those people who are asymptomatic and won't be presenting to a health center, to a hospital, and who are being missed by testing algorithms in many, many countries, including in the United States, in many places. Those are people who may be contributing to transmission. And so we do need to have some of those social containment measures, such as social distancing and other efforts to stop those people transmitting if they aren't identified as positively diagnosed.
Well, let's now, before we run out of time, actually, let's go to Hong Kong, where Gabriel Leung joins us via Skype. He's infectious disease epidemiologist and dean of the medicine at the University of Hong Kong. He's also the founding director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center for Infectious Disease Epidemiology and Control. He led Hong Kong's fight against SARS. So, Dr. Leung, welcome to On Point.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for being with us today. How would you categorize Hong Kong's efforts thus far? How would you describe what's happening in Hong Kong to combat coronavirus?
Well, we've started quite early. We started effectively in the middle of, well, since the middle of January, and we have done a lot of non-pharmaceutical interventions, including social distancing, school closures, as well as very strict quarantine and isolation of close contacts and their index cases. And so far, we have been able to keep the number of infections to 410 as of today in a population of 7.5 million. So I'll leave you to judge how we've been doing. But in any case, we are not letting our guard down. And making sure that we try to keep this at a fairly low level, although we have actually seen some uptick in the last week or so, mostly because we've got quite a number of returnees, mostly overseas Hong Kong students returning home and then bringing the infection back with them, since most of them came back from Europe and North America.
Well, Dr. Leung, since you said that you'll leave me to judge, I judge that Hong Kong is doing very well thus far. But so you led the fight against SARS there in the early 2000s. I'm wondering, for you, what is the difference now versus when SARS came to Hong Kong?
Well, I didn't actually lead the SARS response. I was in the university doing the epidemiological work, obviously contributing to the control effort with government. What I did do was to lead the government response while I was in government in 2009 against the pandemic flu outbreak. But comparing our work during SARS 20 years ago almost, this is a much bigger task. Number one, because COVID-19 is much more transmissible than SARS. And secondly, what we have really been looking at with SARS then was a few months of very serious disruption compared to now with COVID-19. I think that we still have quite a few months, if not a year or more, of work to do. And this is a true global pandemic. So I think the scale, the scope, the intensity are all very different.
Now, Hong Kong, if I'm remembering correctly, have schools and universities, for example, have been closed since Lunar New Year in Hong Kong.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, and so there have been these extraordinary measures taken to help keep those numbers low. I wonder, is there a concern? You were talking about Hong Kong residents returning from abroad. That could be an area of concern. But is there also concern about just how long these restrictive measures can be put in place before just psychologically people either let their guard down or have such a profound desire to return to normal that their behavior goes back to, you know, more social gatherings?
No, of course. I mean, I think that we're all human beings and human beings are social animals. So I think that not just Hong Kong in terms of the response fatigue is what you've been talking about, mm-hmm. but I think that as the world sort of goes forward, we are looking at a prolonged pandemic, and we can talk about why, but I think that it's going to be a tension, a three-way tension between health protection, economic preservation, as well as population adherence and emotional well-being. So it's a three-way trade-off or three-way tug-of-war between keeping people from harm's way as well as keeping the integrity of the health system so that it doesn't implode from the sheer weight of the number of people who would need care. That's health protection. Economic preservation or economic protection is obviously GDP. And then the third axis of this tension is, as you put it, the response fatigue and the population's willingness to continue obliging with these very, very severe disruptions to their lives.
How long do you think we will be trying to strike this balance between those three poles then?
Well, the simple answer is not until at least half of the population has immunity to this bug. Because this bug is completely novel in humans. Nobody has any pre-existing immunity to it, and it doesn't appear that there is good cross immunity from any other related viruses to this. So for all intents and purposes, everybody is susceptible. And therefore, because the basic reproductive number is somewhere around 2 or 2 and a bit, and so a simple rule of thumb, making a few assumptions, simplifying assumptions, would tell us that we probably need at least half of the population to be immune before we would see this settle down. And there are only two ways of getting immunity. One is through natural infection and then recovery. Mm-hmm. And the other way is to get vaccinated by an effective vaccine. Well, we're not going to get an effective vaccine that is sufficiently widely available and accessible until probably earliest end of the year or maybe even next year sometime. So in between now and whenever we have that vaccine, we are looking at several waves, but two at least in my view, of COVID-19 sweeping through populations. And therefore, this is going to be the sort of struggle between these three axes of health protection, economic preservation, and population willingness to oblige.
Right. So can I,
for a while.
Forgive me for interrupting there, Dr. Leung, but I wanted to actually hear Professor Stanley's response to that, because yes, it will be a struggle between those three factors. But I mean, could effective planning, could sort of a comprehensive response see far enough into the future in terms of when those coronavirus waves come, that it's not so much a struggle, that we know how to shift the balance at any point in time as an epidemic plays out? Does that make sense, Professor Stanley?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we are getting more and more data all the time, and hopefully that will inform our future response. You know, clearly managing the pandemic overall is going to be a massive collective effort, as we've just heard. Social cohesion may be tested. And I think overall, it's going to be an opportunity to really come together as communities, as countries, as a global community for the public good. And that being said, of course, as we do have more information about measures that can be taken to prevent transmission and the impacts of these different types of non-pharmaceutical interventions, I am hopeful that we are going to be able to apply those more delicately and more decisively in order to prevent the same impacts that we're seeing now in the course of the months to come.
Mm. Well, Dr. Leung, we've got about a minute left here, and I'm wondering if there's any piece of advice that you might want to offer people here in the United States listening right now, whether they're residents or, you know, even political leaders.
Well, my one piece of advice for everybody anywhere where there is an expanding epidemic, but in the U.S. at the moment, is stay home and stay safe for at least the next 3 weeks so that you allow the bug to run its course, not in the general community, and so that you don't amplify that epidemic force of infection. And for the authorities, try to test, test, and test. And when there are too many to test, test systematically so that you can monitor what is going on.
Mm. Well, Dr. Gabriel Leung is an infectious disease epidemiologist, dean of the medicine at the University of Hong Kong, and founding director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Infectious Disease Epidemiology and Control. Dr. Leung, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
He was in Hong Kong. And Claire Stanley is assistant research professor with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. She joined us today from Heidelberg, Germany. Professor Stanley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Professor Stanley talked about even the world coming together. Well, we're going to go out with some music from the people in a Bavarian town of Bamberg, Germany. They took to their rooftops to sing Bella Ciao, an Italian resistance song in solidarity with Italy. This is On Point.